What impact would a digital euro have on banks and the financial system? The European Central Bank is looking into designing a central bank digital euro, which would effectively represent the digitization of cash. Depending on its design, it could have profound consequences on banks and the financial system in general. Hi, I'm Justin Pugsley, editor of Global Risk Regulator. We have run many stories and podcasts about digital currencies and crypto. And you can find out more on www.globalriskregulator.com. To discuss the ECB's work and views on the digital euro, I am delighted to welcome Ulrich Binzel, Director General of Market Infrastructure and Payments at the ECB. Okay, well, hi Ulrich. Thank you so much for joining us today. Can you start by giving us an update as to where the ECB is at the moment in terms of its work on the digital euro, and also provide a timeline on your future work in this area, some of the sort of milestones that you're aiming for?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Yeah, we are actually in the middle of what we call the investigation phase of a project.
Okay.
That's a well-defined term in ECB jargon. Investigation phase is the first phase of any big project where you end up specifying exactly the functional requirements of the product, the user requirement. And in the case of digital euro, that means quite a bit, you know, it really means what do we want exactly to have as a product. So things like, of course, still philosophical, what objectives do we want to reach? More concrete, what use cases do we have? So which type of payments do we want to cover with digital euro? Then what is the role of the central bank, the euro system, in the issuance and settlement, and what part of it will be done by private market participants? Then also, what compensation model for the digital euro will we have? You know, any payment instrument or scheme typically has a compensation model. Yeah. Take the case of credit cards as one example. Yeah. There's a merchant fee, which is then shared between the various parties which serve the instrument. No, so question, do we need that for a digital euro? How would it look like? Then also the funding and defunding. So how to transfer other forms of central bank money, cash, into digital euro, and how do you transform commercial bank money into it, and vice versa. And what else? Yeah, the distribution in general to the users, that's also something. So all those things are covered in the investigation phase. It started in October 21.
Okay.
Now we are in October 22, and we have one more year. So it's a 2 years phase. And then if the governing council is satisfied with the package it gets, it can decide to move on into the realization phase, as it is called. And that is really then, you know, the software development, the implementation on our side, but also on the side.
Sorry, would that be like the pilot phase?
No.
Okay.
The pilots, that's actually something we are doing now also. Yeah, thanks for mentioning.
Okay.
I mean, we have now the pilots, let me be precise, we now have prototyping. So prototyping is a kind of hands-on development of examples of how certain modules could look like, not anticipating the eventual product, but you know, doing hands-on work together with the industry. So that's part of the current phase.
Yeah.
In the realization phase, I mean, you are seriously just developing what you have decided, what you want to have. No.
Yeah.
So you are no longer prototyping. You are really doing the product that you want to have at the end of the realization phase. And then let me finish. Then you have the decision to issue. Yeah. So our governing council said explicitly, in this case, it goes for the project. It spends the money for the project, but it has not yet decided that the digital euro will be issued.
Yeah.
That is an independent decision, you know, that could be taken in a few years when it's failed, the product is ready and there is a case for issuing.
Right. Okay. Okay. Now, okay. So as you just said, there's no decision has been made yet about launching a central bank digital euro. And obviously that, I guess that would be ultimately a decision for the member states. However, there are alternatives to a sort of digital euro, such as stable coins, or you could even have the tokenization of bank accounts. So I'd just love to get your thoughts about those alternatives, because, you know, if they're properly regulated, they might actually be easier to pursue than launching, you know, a brand new form of central bank money.
Yeah, I mean, let me come back to what you said at the beginning of your question on the member state. The member states would decide. I think it's true, you know, the ECB obviously interacts with the European co-legislator on this question, and there's agreement that the co-legislator will have to legislate, you know, to clarify the exact legal basis of the digital euro and to, you know,
points will come back to shortly.
So that will come, but I wouldn't say it's a decision then of the co-legislator to issue. The decision to issue on the legal basis provided by the legislator is for the ECB governing council at the end.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Well, thank you for that clarification.
Both need to agree. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned stable coins and other alternatives.
That's right.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, that the alternative, the currently existing alternatives anyway, commercial bank money. So there is, you know, there are private payment solutions based on commercial bank money, which cover many use cases. And that's, for now, I would say, the alternative. And we see certain, deficits or deficiencies of the private solutions in Europe.
Okay.
So one has been, the governing council has been explicit on this, the sovereignty argument, the strategic sovereignty. Our payment instruments are more and more dominated by also solutions which, you know, of firms headquartered outside Europe. So in principle, of course, we appreciate those products and the competition they bring. But the trend, you know, if you extrapolate it, there's a lot of predominance of non-European governed firms at the end, which maybe is too much from this perspective of strategic autonomy. But otherwise, you know, for many use cases, you pay in commercial bank money or in instruments which are on top of it.
Yeah.
And stable coins, you know, stable coins was hyped a bit, maybe because they came in the context of new technology, DLT, etc. But I would say, For the big majority of use cases of citizens, I would say it's not so much stable coins which are needed to solve problems, but you know, we have a lot of instruments, we have innovations. We would hope, you know, in our retail payment strategy, we say we hope for a European governed instant payment based POI payment solution.
Okay.
And that we continue to encourage.
Yeah.
But stable coins, you know, can maybe play certain functions. They are 24/7 typically. Okay, they may be based on new technology, which may allow for certain applications. But for me, you know, the stable coin, the DLT technology, which is supposed to make the difference between a stable coin and a knee money institution, let's say, is a bit overrated, if you ask me.
Okay.
So, yeah, regardless of the existence of stable coins, there are private solutions, good solutions, innovative solutions, evolving solutions, but we still have arguments why we believe the digital euro is useful.
Okay, so I guess these different solutions still have to kind of prove themselves because we're in, you know, it's all very new. Okay. Right. Well, there has been some discussion, you know, again, among a lot of academics and certain people in the financial sector as well, that a digital euro would help preserve the single currency's role, you know, geopolitically, and even halts its use globally. Can you discuss the ECB's thinking around that, please?
Yeah, I think it's fair to admit that the digital euro project, as it was now defined, has primarily a domestic focus.
Okay.
It doesn't have this ambition, at least not, you know, for the first release. Who knows about future releases? But for now, you know, when we discuss the use cases, the key use cases we want to cover is person-to-person payments and POI payments, so e-commerce and point of sale, so supermarket, let's say, domestically. And of course, in the long term, there's no doubt that digital central bank money can serve cross-border payments. We would typically say it should be with currency conversion. It should not be maybe global use and holdings of one digital currency, because that could lead to larger capital flows and dollarization. So my intuition would be that what you want to be able to do is like what is offered now by international card schemes, that you can use your digital euro for e-commerce transactions globally, and if you are a traveler abroad, that everywhere it is somehow accepted, but then typically with a currency conversion. And it's something, you know, we keep in mind, and we are in contact with other central banks to think, you know, on interoperability and what can be done. But all this you see is more, you know, a collaborative approach to ensure that CBDC will be useful for cross-border payments. It's not about, I would say, the ambition that the euro plays a bigger role globally, because obviously the digital euro can be used abroad, probably also foreign CBDCs can be used in Europe. And I guess we want symmetry. We want this to be based on an agreement between central banks. And therefore, I wouldn't see it as, you know, being a way of geopolitical, you know, expansion of outreach of the euro and so on.
Oh, okay. No, fair enough. Okay, now I gather the focus is on a sort of retail digital euro. Now, the big concern around that, as I'm sure you keep hearing, is that they could disintermediate deposit-taking institutions if they became too popular, or people rushed into digital euros, say, because of a banking crisis or something. So can you maybe talk a bit about some of the safeguards that you're looking into to stop those kind of things from happening, please?
Yeah, indeed, Justin. And that's also part of the investigation phase. So, you know, there's a thorough analysis of financial stability and monetary policy implications of introducing a digital euro. And I think there's a consensus that you need safeguards because the digital euro as being risk-free, you could say, is of course a very attractive also store of value. And we don't want it to be a large-scale store of value, because the private sector, you know, has a role to play in credit intermediation. We are not in that business primarily, so we don't want to see our balance sheet ballooning and having to hold, you know, billions, trillions and trillions of additional assets and to decide in what to invest and so on. So, yes, we should have limits or maybe remuneration-related incentives, like a tiered remuneration, that if you have high holdings, you know, beyond a certain threshold, the remuneration is a bit unattractive, And the conclusion in the project so far, I mean, it has to be finally endorsed by our governing council, but is to build in both of those instruments.
Oh, so like a hybrid.
Into the scope, yeah. So not to decide now, you know, we have a limit of 3,000 euro per citizen, but to build it with the functionality, the ability to put limits and the ability to put tiered remuneration, so that future policymakers, once they issue a digital euro, can choose which of those tools to activate and where to set the parameters. Yeah, and you know it could depend on the interest rate level. If we have in say 5 year times or whatever when a digital euro will be issued, if we have then an interest rate level, short term interest rate of zero, it's something different than it if it's 5%. If it's 5%, you could say You just don't remunerate digital euro, and then you have incentives, sufficient incentives against large holdings. But if the short-term risk-free rate is at zero, then you need a limit or even, you know, for high holdings, negative remuneration, you need some tools. So therefore, future policymakers should decide this. And now our job is only to put it into the scope of the functional requirements.
So, I mean, would you see these... it sounds to me like the remuneration side would be partly market-driven, market-based, but you then got the caps on holdings. I mean, would you envisage that being a sort of hard cap or one that would evolve with, you know, supply and demand of digital euros to maybe you want to incentivize people more to be in commercial bank accounts, for example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't see it as a kind of dynamic policy tool.
Okay.
I think everybody, as I understand, agrees that digital euro and remuneration or limits are not monetary policy instruments. That if we put limits or disincentives for high holdings through remuneration, it is only to protect financial stability and to protect monetary policy.
Yeah.
You know, I give you a trivial example. When we had the deposit facility rate at minus 50 basis points, you cannot offer unlimited digital euro at 0% remuneration because it would act like a deposit facility. And, you know, market rates cannot be then at minus 50 if everybody could put unlimited amounts at zero, no?
Yeah.
So, and so it is not to have a new instrument of monetary policy, but it is to have an instrument to not have digital euro undermine monetary policy and financial stability.
No, absolutely. Okay, we mentioned, just on that point of the cap, as you just suggested, it could be at 3,000 euros per person. I think a lot of other ECB members have suggested the same. However, a lot of experts say this would make it potentially useless to businesses and capital market players who could, you know, probably massively benefit from a digital euro in terms of reducing frictions, costs, and would help them spur innovation as well. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because they could be the biggest beneficiaries, actually, from a digital euro.
Yeah, I mean, indeed, the digital euro project, as it is now set, and the use cases that were identified are really for a retail digital euro, retail in the narrow sense. And because, you know, there's retail, there's wholesale. Wholesale is often used as covering interbank payments, no? And wholesale CBDC we have because banks have digital accounts with the central bank. But in between is indeed all the corporate payments.
Yeah.
And here we would say it's not a primary focus, and corporates probably will not have the ability to have high holdings. I mean, intraday they should be able to process large amounts of payments.
Yeah.
But my sense would be they cannot sit on a big stock structurally. They can have big flows, and we should provide the elasticity of the specification so that they can have those big flows. But at the end, they should transfer holdings again into commercial bank money. And you could say, yeah, but that is not then maximizing the usefulness of the digital euro. Yes, maybe, but we have to start somewhere. And the focus is now on citizens, on retail in the narrow sense.
Okay.
And of course, future will tell if there's a broadening. You know, even the project as it is now is an ambitious one, because point of sale e-commerce, you know, making those payments convenient and competitive in digital euro is a big endeavor. You know, if you scratch the surface, there are so many questions you need to specify, and we should not overestimate ourselves to be able in one go to solve all payment issues of the world. It's a complex industry, and we have to start somewhere.
I mean, what we're basically just been talking about is a wholesale CBDC versus a retail CBDC. Now, everyone I've talked to thinks a wholesale CBDC would be easier to do. It would also have a lot of benefits. There'd be less financial stability risks. Can you maybe just briefly talk about why you went for the more difficult, challenging retail model as opposed to the easier wholesale one?
Yeah, I mean, we are annoying a bit, I think, by always repeating, wholesale CBDC exists, you know?
Okay.
It's electronic balances with the central bank, you know, M0, the monetary aggregate M0, consists so far of banknotes in circulation and deposits of banks with the central bank. And they can transfer this electronically. We have we have an RTGS system. We have even T2S, which allows DVP settlement of securities and central bank money. So that is central bank digital currency for wholesale.
Okay.
It exists. And those people who talk about wholesale CBDC, what they mean, but in my view, they abuse the terminology. They mean something new in terms of technology. So that you would put that somehow on a DLT, on a blockchain, and that this would allow things like 24/7, or it would allow atomic settlements against digital tokens of assets and so on. And fair enough, but this is not, you know, about introducing wholesale CBDC. It's just about a new technology.
Okay.
And you know, I have no doubt that it would be possible, but many of the problems that the promoters of wholesale CBDC see, you know, to be addressed by this, you know, you can also address them in a central ledger, like 24/7. You know, we have 24/7 settlement in central bank money in a central ledger with tips, for example. And you could, in theory, you know, you could use tips for wholesale payments. So just to say, you know, what they claim is partially things you can develop in a central ledger in the existing, you know, standard form of central bank digital money. And therefore, but we are open, of course, and we currently have a work stream, and we reached out to the market to understand what the exact unique value proposition of DLT in wholesale CBDC could be. And you know, we collected input, we tried to make up our mind, and we will see if we can, you know, think about adding this somehow to the current systems, but we are not very far in concluding.
Okay, well thanks for that explanation. That's actually very useful. I think a lot of our listeners would appreciate that. So let's move on to a basically quite different area now, the one of privacy. Obviously, people in Europe really value that. I think they would want to be able to use their digital euros without them, that all their transactions being tracked by the authorities. Now, obviously, these transactions can never be completely private because, as we noticed, on ledgers to avoid fraud and double counting. So what measures are you exploring that would give the digital euro that desired privacy whilst also discouraging its use for things, you know, criminal activities such as money laundering? I mean, how would you sort of find that balance, basically? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I see two issues. One is really from our perspective, the integrity of our issuance. So as you say, you need a sort of ledger in one technology or another where the holdings are, you know, recorded and settled.
Yeah.
So that's a basic need, you know, for the safety, the integrity of your issue of digital euro. So that's one requirement. And for the rest, I would say the euro system is not interested, of course, in data and is willing to do whatever is possible to maximize privacy. But you also mentioned indeed the constraint coming from the fight against illicit payments, money laundering, terrorist financing. And there I would say, it's not for us as a central bank to say, let's have the digital euro be exempted or be exempted up to a certain amount. Sure. This is for the legislator. You know, we are central bankers. We are not the ones who will decide for society about where to choose a point in the trade-off between fighting illicit payment and privacy. So we are in touch with the commission who kicks off the legislative process and ask the question to the commission, do you want that digital euro maybe has an enhanced privacy for low value payments?
Ah, right.
And, you know, then I would say the ball is in their camp to say if they want to make that part of their legislative proposal on digital euro. And we have to tell them, of course, what is technically feasible, but we should not tell them what choice society should make in this trade-off.
No, that's understood. Okay, Ulrich. Now, I've had some discussions with academics, and they seem to feel there could be an issue with making the digital euro legal tender, as the, you know, as the original treaties and text concerning the euro concerned physical, was written for physical banknotes. So what is your viewpoint on that? I mean, is this something the ECB is looking into, or maybe you already have some potential legal solutions to this?
Yeah, as you say, it's a legal question. I mean, of course, it's also, if you want to call it this way, a business question, because a legal tender status, of course, supports the use, makes it really a standard.
It's a very important
instrument. Yeah, so it supports the success. You know, the penetration of the market with the digital euro and aligns expectations and so on. So it is a powerful tool. And then, is it legally possible? Yes, I would say it's a matter of legislation. And you say that indeed the original text refers basically to physical banknotes, but you know you can explicitly also legislate in the appropriate legislation procedure to expand that to digital euro. And so our lawyers believe this is a choice that the legislator can make.
Okay.
And again, we are in touch with the commission on this topic, and they are working on this, and we will see, you know, their proposal, if and how they will propose that.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, you may know that the implementation of legal tender status for banknotes in the euro area is anyway not very, homogeneous, no? Because you have in quite some countries, you have the interpretation that you can waive the legal tender status contractually. So you put a piece of paper into the entrance door where you say, I don't accept cash as a merchant. And then if you enter the shop, you know, you have waived your right of legal tender contractually. So this is how it is interpreted in some countries. And I understand the commission at the occasion now of discussing legal tender status for digital euro also revisits a bit this implementation, because if you would introduce it for digital euro, you would like to have it, you know, homogeneously applied.
Yeah.
But then you may also want it to be homogeneous for banknotes. So my understanding is the commission is looking into this.
Yeah.
And hopefully they find a good solution.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, indeed. Okay. This is another area, maybe sort of a more very practical area, I guess. Now, you know, most people out there, most citizens that, you know, think of the money in their bank accounts as already being the digitization of cash. So this whole discussion to them is probably rather obscure and academic about, you know, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. Therefore, you know, if it was introduced, how would you educate people about why they should consider using digital euros when, you know, they already have all the convenience of bank accounts, payment solutions, and so on at hand?
Yeah, I mean, I would exactly reverse the point and say, because we are moving to a digital age where maybe all payments one day will be digital, therefore the role of central bank money for non-banks you know, that we had in the past should be there in the future. If we don't have central bank money any longer, then you enter a different world somehow. I mean, the current monetary system is based on the coexistence. And if you want commercial bank money, is, to exaggerate slightly, but it's nothing else than a promise to convert a claim into central bank money, no? So what does it mean in the future digital age if the central bank would, as the only player, decide, I want to stick forever with 17th century technology, because some people tell me that for central banks, banknotes is a normal technology. I mean, that wouldn't make sense. So exactly because we enter a digital age and the coexistence of central bank money and private money makes sense, that's why we also want to move and not stick to this very strange idea, no, to not move with technology. And you can translate this in concrete benefits, like, for example, one fundamental problem with payments is it's a network good, no?
Yeah.
It's easily dominated by very few players who then have a market power and the ability to abuse this market power. And the existence of an offer, you know, designed, a payment instrument designed for citizens, not operated on a profit-maximizing basis, you know, this competition for private providers is in the interest of society, because you can fall back on it. And also, again, you know, it is the anchor of the monetary system, because everything remains convertible into central bank money in a concrete way and not only in a very theoretical way.
Yes, it's kind of like the updating of cash for the digital age. And also sounds like what you're saying is that a digital euro could be a way of, you know, keeping payment services, particularly at the retail level, keeping them competitive, you know, making sure banks offer competitive products, so, you know, people don't get overcharged so much, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, right. Well, maybe our last topic then. Now, programmability has been put to me by a number of people is the potential killer application for a central bank digital currency. What are your thoughts about adding that functionality to the digital euro?
Yeah, I think this term is used in a very confusing manner often.
Okay.
But what is programmability? So some people use it for programmability of money, others for programmability of payments, and, you know, of money is something typically, you know, which we would say doesn't fit with central bank money. Because, you know, if it links, you know, certain constraints or automatism to certain, how to say, units or tokens of money, then the fungibility of money is no longer given.
Yeah.
So we want that every unit is equal, and therefore you should not attach certain things to units of money, at least not to our central bank money.
Yeah.
But what you should have is programmability of payments, in the sense that in principle any machine, any algorithm, any condition should be able to trigger a payment via an API, let's say, an application programming interface. And that's a bit, you know, in the my thinking about it, let me say, is it's similar to the PSD2 idea, that you allow external providers, upon agreement of an account holder, to access the account and to also trigger payments. And there's nothing, you know, from our perspective speaking against a machine then triggering the payment and the machine, you know, taking any conditionality, you know, if it's raining and if the temperature is above 30 degrees, then make this payment. Everything is possible there. We would be completely open to this. And then we have to see, you know, how it works. And let me remark, you know, that those people who say, well, we have to do that, look at, you know, what exists currently in Europe. The PSD2 idea is a very good idea, but it is still, you know, struggling with implementation. And also in Germany, you know, I hear that it's a legal issue that machines are not allowed to trigger payments because only humans, according to the legal framework, apparently, can trigger payments. So just to say, there are lots of other conditions to make this type of approach effective, and it could, you know, have been deployed massively already today with commercial bank money. And if it is not, then my sense is there are other constraints or maybe a relatively limited use case. So you see, I'm not such a strong believer yet in very fancy applications for payments like Internet of Things and so on. Again, we are of course open to them, and you know, future will tell. And the digital euro will not, you know, having the digital euro is a sign that we want to move with technology.
Yeah.
But we have to start somewhere. And the use cases we want to cover in the first go are ambitious, and programmability beyond this, maybe open access to accounts in the side of PSD2. Beyond that, maybe it's not at the very center of our first release of digital euro.
So I maybe that whole programmability area, maybe simpler to leave that maybe to stablecoins, and that, you know, we're operating in very specific niches such as supply chains, you know, making those work, or machine to machine payments.
Yeah, I think we are fine that the private sector is at the forefront of innovation.
Yeah,
and if this becomes a big use case, then I would see no reason that we don't follow and offer it.
Oh, right.
But we are not an IT startup, of the ambitious use cases we want to cover. We are the ones, you know, who will find the solution how to make this type of technology useful if it's not yet deployed at all, you know, in practice. Yeah. So far, stablecoins mainly serve the interfacing of the, you know, crypto asset universe with the rest of the monetary system. So it's a niche use. I mean, doesn't mean that it wouldn't change in the future, but let's observe it and then let's see how we could react here.
And to conclude, I'd like to thank Ulrich for sharing some very interesting and valuable insights about the possibility of introducing a digital euro. If you're interested in these kind of topics, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. And if you'd like to hear future podcasts from us, you can subscribe via Acast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And finally, I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.